The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Good morning and welcome. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour, Hour 2 of the Bible Study here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks again to Pastor Bob Howder from Couts, Indiana, where he serves at St. Paul Lutheran Church, for our study in Exodus chapter 23. But joining us now is Pastor Kirk Clayton, who serves at Zion Lutheran Church. A lot of Lutheran guys show up here at KFUO. Have you noticed that, Pastor?
It's strange how that works, isn't it?
Yeah. You can't turn and spit without having a Lutheran around here. Have you noticed that?
Oh, please don't spit too far.
I'm fairly close across the table here.
Let's not do that. That may have been a sacred thing in the time of Jesus, but times have changed a little bit.
I noticed we did not greet each other with a holy kiss as you came in.
No, we didn't. We didn't even do the holy handshake.
No, we didn't.
But it's good to see you anyway.
Good to see you as well.
Always good to be here.
Hey, happy Father's Day. I know you've got a whole flock at home.
Blessed with five.
Five of them. What are you aiming for? 17, 18?
Whatever the Lord provides.
Agree?
Yeah, whatever the Lord provides. Children are a wonderful, beautiful gift from Him, and so we rejoice in His blessing and generosity.
Well, you'll be worshiping Sunday, obviously, but then what plans have you for after church? Anything special planned?
I plan to hole up and do a lot of reading.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exciting day.
Get all of them out of the house so you can have some quiet, or are you going to go off somewhere on your own?
Either them out of the house or me out of the house. We'll have to see which one works better, yeah. But have a lot of reading to get done for Sunday afternoon.
What is it about Father's Day where we sort of go, well, get them all away from me? Isn't that kind of antithetical to the day?
We kind of did a makeup last Wednesday already, expecting that, you know, restaurants would be packed and so on Sunday.
Go.
We went out on Wednesday night, this last Wednesday, instead, so that when Sunday comes, we can avoid the rush, and we'll just be fairly antisocial.
Pastor Kirk Clayton, a man with a plan.
Yeah.
There you go.
And just hide myself in some hole somewhere and read a lot.
Well, let me grab my text here from Exodus 23, because as you were sitting in the lobby, you were listening to Bob Howder and I, as we wrapped up on this, and you get to this text in Exodus where it talks about, you shall serve the Lord your God. This is verse 25 of chapter 23. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. Well, then the question was raised, if God can alleviate suffering, sickness, why doesn't he?
Well, I think as tempting as that view is of saying, well, why doesn't God just remove all evil in the world? We really, deep down, don't want that. If God would remove all evil, or if God would remove all suffering, which is a consequence of evil, the world would become utterly immoral. There would be no standards of right and wrong. For example, if we really want God to remove all consequences of doing evil, which is what suffering is. Suffering, because of the fall into sin, is a consequence of doing evil, by and large. Do we really want all consequences of evil to be removed? For example, if a horrible child molester has viciously raped a series of young girls and women, do we really want there to be no consequences for that action? When we say that we want God to remove all suffering as a result of evil, that's what we're saying. And I don't think that is what we want at all. We want to see that there is right and there's wrong, that there's injustice and there is justice, that there is evil and there is punishment. We tend to be a very black and white society on that. We want there to be punishment for evil. And if God were to alleviate all suffering, which is the result of evil, God would be making the world immoral. Now, I don't think we want that. Now, the other side of the argument is, oftentimes people blame God for, well, why does God allow suffering? Why does this is all God's fault. This is a mess that God has created. Well, no, first we need to understand that evil is our fault, not God's. God created the world to be good and we fell into sin. That is our problem, not his. Now, it's also very odd to point to God as the one to blame when he's the only one who's actually doing anything good about this problem of evil. I want to share an example from Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, who teaches the Apologetics Academy every summer in Strasbourg, France. We've talked about this almost every time
that
I'm on with you, that it's a great opportunity in Strasbourg, France, to study with some real leaders in the field of apologetics. But Dr. Montgomery gives this example. He says, what if in a major city, we're sitting in St. Louis, let's use St. Louis as an example. In St. Louis, all of the garbage collectors, I guess nowadays they're called sanitation engineers, right?
Something like that.
Yes. We used to call them trash collectors. Then they're garbage collectors, now they're sanitation engineers. They all decide to go on strike. All garbage trucks sit idle. What would be the result in the city of St. Louis?
Lots of garbage everywhere.
Garbage piling up. You'd set it at the curb. It wouldn't go anywhere. You'd bring next week's garbage out. It wouldn't go anywhere. And it's going to rot. It's going to fester. It's going to stink. It's going to start causing disease. And let's say the garbage collector or sanitation engineers union does not budge. Zero trash trucks are moving. Nothing is being done about the problem. Then, several weeks in, a month in, when things are really rotten, literally, they're rotting in the street, one sanitation engineer decides to go to his truck, and he starts making the rounds and picks up all the garbage that he can on this street and hauls it away. He comes back the next day and picks up all the garbage that he can on another street and hauls it away. What's the reaction of the people? Ironically, the people aren't thankful for the garbage collector doing the work that he is. Everybody's getting mad. Well, why did he go to your street and not to my street? And so they are getting angry at the garbage man for the one and only person who's doing anything about the situation, but instead of giving him thanks and credit, they're blaming him for the problem of not getting their street fixed up. And obviously, this is what is going on with God. God is the only one who's doing anything good about the situation of suffering and evil. And what is he doing? He has sent his Son, Jesus Christ. You can't do more than send your own beloved Son into the world. And what did Jesus do in the world? He healed the sick. He lived among the poorest of the poor. He gave all that he had. He sacrificed his life for us. And what do people do? They blame him as the problem, not the answer. And so just as ridiculous as it is to blame the one garbage collector, the one sanitation engineer, who's actually trying to help, so ridiculous it is to blame God for the problem of evil when we are the cause of the problem and God is the only one who's doing anything good about it. I think that's a very helpful analogy from, again, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, whose Apologetics Academy will be probably kicking off in about 2 weeks in Strasbourg, France.
You're not attending this year.
But I'm not attending this
year. You're working on this little thing called the doctorate.
Yeah, there is that.
A little preoccupied.
Yeah, that's what the reading for Sunday is about.
Yeah.
But it'll be too late to register for this year. If listeners are interested, certainly check it out on the web and look into it for the following year.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. You can get in on any subject you like today, any question. Maybe you didn't get a chance to call in during Exodus, or I didn't cover something well enough. You want some amplification on that, you can certainly call. But then I've got my stack of things here as well. And I would just note, Pastor, that you and I are sort of contemporaries. We're very close in age, and in spite of the fact that you look so much better than I do.
you have less hair, but I have more gray hair, I think, so
yeah,
that's kind of a wash.
The thing I remember...
That's the beauty of radio, isn't it?
Yeah.
What is it? I have a face made for radio?
Yeah absolutely. The thing I remember as a kid, I don't remember if it was late 70s, early 80s, but there was that garbage strike in one of the northern cities. Maybe it was Cleveland, Chicago, someplace like that, and there was trash piling up everywhere, and I remember the story they did, because I remember watching it on Channel 2 here in St. Louis, of a woman who got very clever, and what she would do is she would take her garbage, put it in a box, and then wrap it up like a Christmas present, put it in the back of her car and leave the trunk open. People,
please,
I kid
steal
you not,
it.
They would steal it.
Oh, I was thinking of the infamous garbage barge that floated around the Atlantic coast.
That one too. Yeah. Hey, here's something else. Now, this may be of interest of someone who serves the church. Mysterious bones may belong to John the Baptist.
Okay.
Does that matter to you?
On the one hand, we don't root our faith in other than the Word of God. And so my primary concern about John the Baptist is what we read in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that John appeared in the wilderness preaching a gospel of repentance and forgiveness of sins and pointing people to Jesus Christ. And the wonderful message that John had in recorded in John chapter 1, look, there is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. John didn't take the credit for himself as a great prophet. He constantly pointed people to Jesus. He said, that's the one. That's the Lamb who will be sacrificed for the salvation of the world. That is what is truly most important about John the Baptist. But on the other side of things, it's always nice when there is some form of documentary evidence that what took place in the Bible really existed. A great example of this, I don't know the specifics about John the Baptist, but one very famous case involving Pontius Pilate.
The Pilate Stone. Yeah.
In popular scholarship 100 years ago, 150 years ago, the claim was made that nobody in the Gospels actually really existed. They were all made up, including Pontius Pilate. He never even really lived. Of course, the extension of that is that Jesus never really lived, but they went so far as to say that even Pontius Pilate never really lived. And then an archaeological excavation came along that found a stone that said Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea, dedicates this building to, I believe it was Tiberius Caesar, to his honor, or something like that. And so chiseled stone, and I think it was about 3-inch-high letters from the first century A.D., was the name Pontius Pilate, saying Pontius Pilate, the governor, dedicates this building. Dr. Paul Meyer, who I know is a great fan and friend of KFUO, has a great phrase. He says,
hang on for 1 second. For some reason, you have cut out on me. Let me hit the button and play with the pot. Try again.
Okay.
No, you're gone. Tell you what, slide over to the other mic over there. That happens to us every now and again. I apologize for that. But, you know, we will cope. Whichever one you prefer, my friend, just pull it close to you. If you grab that one on the boom there, that'll probably work better for you. That's number two.
Okay,
we back? You're back. Thank you so much. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to stand up now so you can see me.
I was going to say Dr. Paul Meyer, who I know is a great friend of this station, has a wonderful phrase about the Pilate inscription. He says he would like to go back in time and find the person who said that Pontius Pilate never existed and take him to this Pontius Pilate inscription stone and take his nose and rub his nose in every indentation of that 3-inch inscription of Pontius Pilate. So this is a great phrase from Dr. Paul Meyer. So that by Braille method alone, he could learn that Pontius Pilate truly existed.
Well, here's the background on these bones that are attributed to John the Baptist. The story is from Live Science, if anybody wants to check this out. Live Science, the website. A small handful of bones found in an ancient church in, of all places, Bulgaria. I'm sorry you're having trouble today. Everything worked fine during the first... Satan doth vex us so, does he not?
Yeah, we're fine.
Now, this is in, of all places, Bulgaria, and it's a sarcophagus that they found. Now, the scientists and the archaeologists who are working on this say, even though things point to this being John the Baptist, at least some of the remains of John the Baptist, there's no way to be absolutely sure, but they found these bones in a sarcophagus, and it was near a second box that bore the name St. John, as well as his feast date of June 24th. Okay, so...
Now, what jumps out at me from that story so far is that the bones were found in what's called a sarcophagus, mm-hmm. and for... listeners who are not as familiar with first century Jewish burial practices, that is very authentic, that the burial practices used only for about 100 years, right around the time of John the Baptist and Jesus, was that you would take the body after it was after it died, and you would place it in a tomb. Basically, we don't like to think in these terms, but for 1 year to decay and all of the flesh to rot off, and then you would take the bones, just the bones, and you'd gather them up, and then you'd place these bones into a carved stone box, which is probably, 2 to 2.5 feet long, roughly about the longest length of the bone, and longest bone of the body, which I believe is your femur. And then the bones, only the bones, would be placed in that sarcophagus, that bone box, for then future burial. So that it would point to a first century burial. And if there, you know, I would be curious, was there a head included? Of course, that's the obvious question when you have Herod had John the Baptist beheaded. Okay, go ahead.
This is part of the story here. Now, it says they've used radiocarbon dating as well as DNA testing, and they've narrowed down that the age of the bones themselves date to the first century, which is consistent with John the Baptist. And they also say that the human bones are from the same person, is from a male, and there's a very highly likelihood, based on the DNA, that it is of Near East or Middle Eastern origin, which is where John the Baptist would be from. So far, so good, right? Okay. So the bones were found in 2010 while there was an excavation going on at this church. The church is located on an island called Sveti Ivan, which roughly translates to St. John's Island, and the church was constructed in two periods in the 5th and 6th centuries. Okay. And apparently this sarcophagus also chronicles a man named Thomas who was charged with bringing this bone box to the dedication of this church under the patronage of someone who must have been fairly wealthy. And and that goes back to the tradition of the churches, I guess, number one, you wanted the pilgrim trade, but number two, when you constructed a church and you wanted it to be special, you tried to secure some kind of holy relic for it.
Tried to get something that would draw people in and be a big name, kind of like a concert today. You want to have a big name that's the headliner of the concert to draw people in. And so in those days, I guess the big name was someone who's... bones were available who happened to be dead.
This sarcophagus was buried under the altar, and it says that inside were 6 human bones and 3 animal bones.
Well, I'm not sure what the specific significance is there.
Well, you know, at the time of the Reformation, there's a pretty good going trade in reliquies.
Yeah, and what did Martin Luther say? There's enough thorns from the true cross going around to make hundreds of crosses.
The inscription on the second box that was found says, "Dear Lord, please help your servant Thomas," who is the man who was apparently charged with bringing these remains to the church. They say, "We can imagine that the construction of this church was predicated on the basis of this very important gift."
Yeah,
and then just very quickly to your point, here's what it included.
Okay. Right,
no head.
Well, that would be a good indication.
But close. There was a tooth, part of a cranium, a rib and an ulna, which is the arm bone, and they don't say what the other types of bones were, the animal bones, but apparently there was the one they tested was a knuckle because that was the one that had the most material. So you've got a good dispersion of bits. Of the Baptist.
Now, something interesting that took place was now about 10 or 15 years ago is that the bone box of Caiaphas, the high priest who put Jesus on trial and found him guilty of blasphemy and passed him along to Pontius Pilate, was found. That, in my mind, probably is the most authentic and trustworthy of the ancient relics that has been found. The box that the bones were in was highly ornately carved, beautifully, elaborately decorated, as you'd expect from one who was one of the highest ranking members of Jewish society of his day. Then about the same time, maybe a little bit after, a bone box was discovered that was labeled as James. Now there are a whole lot of Jameses, and so there's a debate raging. Is this the James who was the brother of Jesus, half-brother, step-brother of Jesus, and the bishop of the church in Jerusalem? That one, in my mind, is a little bit more open to question. And then these relics of John the Baptist, with the sarcophagus, it sounds like being from about the 5th or 6th century, there is some removal of time there, so we don't know for sure. But without doubt, Christianity is the most documented religion in the world. If you were to go to any other faith, if you were to go to Islam, if you were to go to Buddhism, if you were to go to Hinduism, if you were to go to Mormonism, if you were to go to any of the other world religions, they would crave the physical evidence that we have. All of these other religions are faiths and nothing but faiths. In fact, they're faiths often in the exact face of opposite evidence. Now, what Christianity is one of the only religions in the world that is falsifiable. Now, this sounds strange to talk in these terms, that the strength of Christianity is it can be proven false. But that is a strength. If I tell you a story that cannot be disproved, what does that mean? It also can be completely made out of thin air and there's nothing to it. For example, if I said, once upon a time, you know there's going to be nothing verifiable or falsifiable in the story. If I say, once upon a time, there was a rich king who was a really mean guy, but I'm not telling you who it is or where it is or when it was or anything like that or any circumstances around, you can do absolutely nothing to verify or falsify that story. Now, contrast that to the Gospels. For example, look at the beginning of Luke, where Luke says, I've undertaken to thoroughly investigate this and to write an orderly account. And then he starts naming names. This was in the days of Tiberius Caesar, when Quirinius was governor of Syria, and there was this taxation, and he starts naming names and dates as to when this took place. This is not a once upon the time fairy tale. What the possible bones of John the Baptist, what the bones of Caiaphas, what all the other archaeological evidence of Christianity from the first century does is say this is in fact rooted in history, and we can have a much higher level of trust and certainty about what is taking place in Christianity than we can in any other religion in the world. That doesn't remove the importance of faith. We do believe, but we believe based on a lot of convincing evidence and reason. Not reaching to 100%, but there is convincing documentary evidence that supports Christianity. It doesn't prove Christianity. Still leaves room for faith, but there is evidence that supports it strongly.
What's interesting, and we'll cover a little bit of this actually on Studio A tomorrow in the 1 o'clock hour with my friend Dr. Tim Furnish, because there is some discussion about which was worse, jihad or crusades. But the one thing that you glean out of this story that's really interesting is one of the historical researchers, who's an Oxford professor by the name of George Kazan, was talking about how the relics were moved out of Jerusalem by the 4th century. Now, what coincides with what's going on in the 4th century?
Well, that would be about the time that Constantine came to power and Christianity moved from being an illegal sect to the official religion of the empire. And so the 4th century tends to be a time when many churches and very large churches are built, when Christianity in its early days was an illegal sect that was persecuted. Worship took place either in homes or in caves or early in the morning, in the wee hours of the morning when nobody was out, so that they would not be detected. Then, when Christianity becomes the official legal religion of the Roman Empire, then, of course, Christians can worship much more openly and move into bigger spaces. And they need to move into bigger spaces because of the evangelistic fervor that's sweeping the Roman Empire in favor of Christianity. And so they move into, sometimes it was old pagan temples that they renovated, or sometimes it was newly built churches for that purpose. Constantine's mother, Helena, was a great woman to build churches. I believe the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, if I remember correctly, has roots in her building program. Yeah. The Church of the Holy Nativity in Bethlehem also is rooted in the building of Constantine's mother, Helena. And so if the relics were moved from Jerusalem about the 4th century, this is the time that these churches were being built, and it would be very authentic that that would be the time that this happened, because Christianity went from being an illegal sect to being tolerated to being the official religion of the state, moving out into public worship places.
The other thing they say is that evidence surrounding these two little bone boxes that they found suggests that they were shuttled through the city of Constantinople before they were dispersed out to the island of St. John.
Mm-hmm.
Which means what he speculates is they may very well have been a gift from the authorities at that time to this little church in Bulgaria.
And Constantinople would have just been on the ascendancy during that time period as, frankly, Rome had become an unlivable cesspool.
Yeah.
And so Constantine, who's the emperor, decided he didn't want to have anything to do with living near Rome because it was decaying and it stank. And so he founded Constantinople as a second capital of the empire and moved there. And so this would have been exactly the time that Constantinople was.
You know what
the problem was?
Yeah. A bunch of Germans and Frenchmen showed up.
Yeah, the Goths,
the Goths,
the Visigoths,
the Visigoths,
yeah.
And
probably did a renovation project, if anything else, by destroying Rome. It was thoroughly rotten and corrupted from the inside already. I mean, if you look at the number of people living in that amount of space and the problems with sewage and sanitation, I mean, literally, the place stunk. And so Constantine wanted nothing to do with it, moved out.
505-7. We'll go anywhere on this program. This
absolutely.
History is a wonderful thing. It's fun to talk about these things. Join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. KFUO at KFUO.org. Pastor Kirk Clayton, our guest this morning. He serves at Zion Lutheran Church over in Muskoda, Illinois. And, as we go to the break here, Pastor, are you a happy person? Do you consider yourself happy?
Rejoice in the Lord always.
Is it the purpose of church to make me happy? And can you say that we as a people are sort of a happiness-obsessed people? And is there necessarily anything wrong with it? We're going to talk about the happiness index. Yay. When you get back.
It makes me glad to do so.
This is the Ask the Pastor program on listener-supported KFUO Radio. We'll be right back after these few short announcements.
Servanthood is a core value of Concordia Seminary. To be a servant is alien to so many people in our society. Even some clergy take on authoritarian airs. But Jesus, Son of God and Lord of all, came as a servant. We want Concordia graduates to model servanthood to their congregations and to their communities. Servanthood, that's the Christian way.
Friday on Issues Etc., we'll respond to your questions and comments sent via email and the Issues Etc. comment line. We'll talk with Sarah Pulliam Bailey of Get Religion about media coverage of religion, and we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week.
Issues Etc. live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO Radio.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AM 850 KFUO underwriter.
On the next Lamplighter Theater.
Let me know where Gilbert is.
How would I know? He's your friend.
You smell of smoke and ale. You were at the racetrack, weren't you?
I'll tell you this much. If Gilbert doesn't have someone rescue him in the next few minutes, he's sure to lose more than his shirt.
I can pay you what I owe. I only need to write to my mother.
Write to your mother? You'll pay me now!
Don't miss the next Lamplighter Theater.
Saturday mornings at 11 on KFUO Radio.
A senator touted as a possible running mate for Mitt Romney says President Barack Obama's administration treats religious freedom as a second-class right. Ohio Senator Rob Portman told the Faith and Freedom Coalition that conscience rights were treated as a mere afterthought or inconvenience in the health care law's birth control mandate.
Despite deep-felt concerns expressed by religious employers, the Obama administration has refused to back down.
Another vice presidential prospect, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, said people of faith aren't trying to impose their religion on others.
It's never been about that. On the contrary, it's been about the fact that we want to live in a country with the freedom so we can live our values and our lives.
South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint agreed.
We don't need the government to push our values. We don't need the government to push our faith and our religion. But we do need to stop the government from purging faith from the American way of life.
Mitt Romney is among the Washington Conference's scheduled speakers. I'm Steve Coleman.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Father's Day is coming up, and it's a very special time for me personally, not because of any gifts or events, but because it celebrates the most important job I've ever had, being a dad. Never will we have the honor of working so hard and being so fulfilled all at the same time. The job comes with tears and sorrow, but also with many thrills and joys. Some dads will struggle with sadness on Father's Day because they've lost a child to illness, accident, or even abortion. But know this, your Heavenly Father deeply loves and cares for you. Through the blood of Jesus, you're able to move on and maybe even help other men facing similar circumstances. Nothing can change the fact you're a dad. So on Father's Day, celebrate God's grace to you.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Welcome back. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. Pastor Kirk Clayton alongside as we talk about, well, pretty much a variety of things in the news. It's Friday, so sometimes you will find that on Friday I take a bit of license with what I find in the news. And, well, sometimes to the enjoyment of the listeners and even to the enjoyment of the pastor who's sitting here having to cope with me, these things actually work out pretty good. Now, as we went to the break, I said, are you a happy guy, Pat? And you said, rejoice in the Lord always, which was a dodge of the question. Are you a happy person?
Well, I've heard a distinction made, and I think it's a good one, between happiness and joy. And the passage I quoted, rejoice in the Lord always, doesn't indicate that Christians will always necessarily be happy, but we can be filled with joy. Now, the distinction I've heard is this. Happiness is situational. Happiness depends on what is going on around you. Joy is not dependent on the situation. Joy is dependent on the peace and tranquility that we enjoy regardless of what's going on around.
Well, to that distinction, listen to this short report.
Everybody wants to live a good life, and I presume we want people in the future to live good lives. We created the Happy Planet Index really to highlight the tension between creating good lives now and good lives in the future.
Because we think people should be happy and the planet should be happy, why don't we create a measure of progress that shows that? And what we do is we say that the ultimate outcome of a nation is how successful is it at creating happy and healthy lives for its citizens.
Economic activity tends to be taken as a sign of the sort of strength and power of a nation, and yet all it is just economic turnover. What the Happy Planet Index does is it takes two things, really. It's looking at the well-being of citizens in countries, and then it's looking at how many resources they use. It creates what we would call an efficiency measure. It says how much well-being do you get for your resource use. It's like a miles per gallon, bang per buck indicator.
Running horizontally along the graph is ecological footprint, how much pressure we put on the planet. More is bad. Running vertically upwards is a measure called happy life years. It's like a happiness-adjusted life expectancy. And the yellow dot there you see is the global average. The challenge really is to pull the global average up here. That's what we need to do. And if we're going to do that, we need to pull countries from the bottom and we need to pull countries from the right of the graph. And then we're starting to create a happy planet.
You can download the report, you can check out your own personal HPI score. It's the first global index of sustainable well-being.
And, Pastor, if you reach into the seat back in front of you, you'll find an air sickness bag.
I was just going to say I might need to excuse myself and go use the restroom. And
you see, we have to be a happy planet
now. Give back some breakfast
now.
Or something. Yeah, no, that report did not make me very happy.
Yeah.
Although, it is a great blessing for anybody to speak with a British accent. It automatically commands more respect and authority
it
than
does.
It deserves,
so
doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
No,
my.
Well, that does go to culture today, because there is this idea that we're always supposed to be happy. And is the church, is it the purpose of being of the church that it is to make people happy?
Well, let's look at this supposed happiness index that this gentleman with the most persuasive voice has laid out. He's rooting it in consumption and economy, right?
Right, exactly.
Which basically is the idea that he who dies with the most toys wins. Get more stuff, but use fewer global resources to do it, and you're happy and at peace. Well, I think generally you find that the more stuff people have, the more stuff people want, and the more possessions we have, the more dependent we become on keeping those possessions, which is a very stressful and not happy, or not certainly not joyful situation.
George Carlin, though vulgar at times, does a great shtick on stuff. Which goes, in short, something to the effect of, you know, your purpose in life is to acquire stuff. So you get some stuff. And then you look around and you say, I have no room for my stuff. So you get a bigger place. And as soon as you put your stuff in the bigger place, you look around and go, look, all the room. I need more stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so.
And it becomes a vicious, vicious cycle. There are many studies that have shown that the greatest indicator of unhappiness is the degree that a person is tied up in materialism. Stuff does not bring happiness, and this seems to be what this wonderful gentleman is basing his happiness quotient on, is the acquisition of stuff through the economy and turning over wealth.
We're going to make you play Scrooge this winter in the Christmas pageant.
Bah, humbug! You know, we're having way too much fun for a Friday.
Yeah. No, this is what Fridays are built for.
Yeah, we dare not do this on Monday, have hate mail coming in for cheering up people's Mondays. Instead, joy comes not from what we have, but the relationship that we know in Jesus Christ. And as St. Paul writes the letters, rejoice in the Lord always, again I will say rejoice, this is in Philippians. He writes Philippians, it's almost certain, from jail.
The jail cell, yeah.
And Paul says, I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, including rotting in jail or being possibly, probably not at the time of this writing, but future, on death row in jail. Says the secret of being content in every all situations is found in knowing that Jesus Christ has done all things for us, and in him we can have great contentment. And so I had the great blessing when I was in college of spending a couple of weeks on a mission trip in Latvia and Lithuania and Russia. And one of our tour guides when we got to Moscow was the chairman of the English department of the University of Moscow. So a very, very high-ranking position. I'm sure she had her doctorate in English. And what was she doing? She was stepping on tour buses to give tour guides in English around the city because she made more money at that than teaching. If I recall correctly, her salary as a professor, chairman of the department at the most prestigious university in the Eastern world, was $20 a month. That's the economic situation of Russia when I was there. Now, this has been a few years ago, but the people, the professor said that she could provide food for her family of bread and basic staples. She could not afford to provide them with eggs for breakfast every day. They could eat as long as it was bread and grains. She could not afford more than that as the chairman of a university department. Now, the host families that we stayed with, extremely, extremely poor in terms of economic wealth. On this global happiness scale, they would have been probably at the very bottom. You know, they may have been towards the left side, not using a lot of world resources either, but they were extremely impoverished. But content, satisfied, generous, giving, and joyful. It is a great lie of Western culture. I'll say that again, a lie of Western culture that more stuff makes you happier. It doesn't. There was a great quote from, I think, was it Carnegie or Getty, one of the huge multimillionaires of the 20th century, not late 19th century, said, millionaires don't smile very much. The more stuff you have, the more worry you have in maintaining and achieving more of it. Whereas the great joy is found in knowing that our full sufficiency is in God and we can trust him. That's why I made the distinction between happiness and joy. This guy may be talking about happiness, but happiness is just shallow, empty, and fleeting. And more often than not, the search for happiness leads to despair. What we see in culture is despair everywhere we look because there's no meaning, there's no purpose, because the lie has been that that meaning and purpose will be found in stuff. It isn't. That meaning and purpose is found in our relationship with Jesus Christ, who's loved us and given himself for us. That's where joy is found.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. Talking a little bit about the happiness index, we want to have a happy
planet.
Which
made me very unhappy.
Very unhappy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I asked a question about, is it the purpose of church to make me happy? And let me tie that into something that only for a Friday would make sense on Ask the Pastor. Here's the headline from, of all places, the Huffington Post. So we know there's some presuppositions in this, but listen to where this goes. The headline is A Theology of America's Zombie Apocalypse.
I'm not happy again.
Not happy again. Now that's not the tie. This fellow talks about, his name is Christian Piot, and he writes regularly for the Huffington Post. Seems, he says, that that America is on the verge of a zombie apocalypse. He talks about the things that have recently been in the news that have been quite shocking. And he says, is it just a coincidence that this spate of violent attacks comes when the country's fascination with zombies is at its height? And he wants to know if there's a connection between, well, the fact that we are fascinated with this zombie apocalypse and these events that are actually taking place in real life.
Like, it seems to me the last time I was with you was just about the time that these two naked men were arrested on the freeway in Florida eating each other's face.
Something like that.
Yeah,
yeah, that's where this all began.
Now, right. Which I guess comes down to the question of, does art imitate life or does life imitate art?
Which,
and
is the,
I think it's a vicious circle. Can so-called artists in the media and TV and so on, can they say, oh, we're just depicting life as we see it? Well, is there sin in the world? Yes. But does their prevalence of what they show in terms of immorality and so on then likewise influence culture to become further debased than it is? Yes. So I think there's a cycle. Does life imitate art? Yes. Does art imitate life? Yes. And as art imitates life getting worse, what happens? Life then imitates art and gets still further worse and more despair and so on. But if I could back up just a minute, you started with the question, is it the job of the church to make people happy? That was a great modern presupposition, too, that these huge mega churches in the modern era were all about making people happy. And you think about the power of positive thinking and such things. And the purpose of church is not to make you happy. In fact, sometimes it's just exactly the opposite. Sometimes the purpose of the church is to say, you know what? You are living a life that is fully worthy of God's judgment and condemnation, and you need to repent. And this is not just, you know, the big sins, supposedly like adultery or murder or theft or things like that. You are slandering your neighbor. You are not helping your neighbor in need. You are not giving of yourself for the good of other people. You are lying. You are cheating.
Listen to what Christian P.I.
We can't
said.
Stop there. We've got to come back to it.
But I think it's important to interject here because this is the connection between the happiness and is church supposed to make me happy in this zombie story on a Friday morning here. Where does faith, church, and or God enter into all of this is the question this author asks, and here is in part how he answers that question. For starters, there is a common thread among nearly everyone who finds their way to a community of faith these days. It's no longer a church, it's now communities of faith. They're not looking for absolution from their sins. They're not looking for a golden ticket to eternal salvation. They're looking for the very things I mentioned above that are lacking: meaning, belonging, connection, and essentially, happiness.
So you can...
I have a method to my madness here, don't I?
You can belong just so long as you have a vampire bite your neck and you become a vampire too, right?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Here, okay. Join the club.
To go back to what I was talking about, that sometimes the job of the church often is actually to make people very uncomfortable in their sinful lifestyles, but not to leave them there, but to proclaim the wonderful message that despite the wretched, unworthy people that we are, God has come to us and made us his own, which is exactly the relationship that people are hungering for. Not a false, phony relationship in zombies or in vampires or in whatever the other...
It gets better. It gets better. He has a second point, the purpose of the church, and it ties back to this whole happiness thing. He says, second, we, meaning faith communities, as he would define them, offer an antidote to the epidemic of fear that plagues our daily life. From our health and waistline to climate change and terrorism, there's plenty to obsess about. It's easy to convince ourselves that everything is falling apart. But deep down, we long to be liberated from our fear. In other words, we want to be
happy. Well, you know, I have a tough time making the connection between a freedom from fear and a world of zombies and vampires. So that just doesn't equate in my mind.
Well, this is what passes for Christian journalism.
That does come back to the message of the Christian church should be one of community, one of relationship, one where people are loved as Jesus has loved us. Does Jesus leave people in their sins? No, Jesus never left people in their sins, and he brought them face to face with the reality of what they were doing wrong. But then he showed his undeserved love for them. And when people come into church, for one thing, they should be, if they are in sin, they should be very uncomfortable, and we all are. But we should know the acceptance and love of Jesus Christ, also expressed in the welcome and the hospitality extended by our brothers and sisters in Christ. As I get together with the faithful at Zion Mascoutah on Sunday, one of the things that I love to see, yes, we have sermon, we have confession of sins and absolution, we receive the gift of the Lord's Supper, but what I love to see also is after that, I always stand at the back and shake people's hands, and it's not at all unusual that, you know, a third of the congregation doesn't come through the line because they are chatting and talking about what's going on in your life and how are, how's your grandpa doing? Or I see that your son was in the hospital. How's that going? Mm-hmm. What can I do for you? And just enjoying this communal life together. And that is a wonderful outgrowth of the love that Jesus has shown for us, as I think is exemplified in the Lord's Supper, that in the Lord's Supper we're gathered together around the table of the Lord, and Jesus comes to us. Jesus says, "Here, receive me and be mine as I am in you. So then you are in me, and as I am in your neighbor, so you are in your neighbor, and we are one." And so this longing for acceptance and community and fellowship that's referenced in this story is exactly what Jesus does for us in worship and specifically in the Lord's Supper. And then we pray that that spills over after the service to the love that's shown to the people that are there.
Let's bring John in on this. Mm-hmm. John, good morning. Thanks for the call. You're on with Pastor Clayton. Go ahead.
Good morning, Pastor Clayton.
Good morning, John.
Wanted just to make a quick comment on this little happiness factor that you guys are having this discussion about. I am newer in the faith, and one of the things that drew me to the LCMS and some of the studies and teachings and things that I'd been going through with them was just how uncomfortable it actually did make me. And I didn't mean that in a bad sense.
Right, right.
I had went to a lot of churches that, it seemed as if when you went there, a lot of, mostly non-denominational churches is what I had went to. And I was amazed as when I was on this search that I was going through those churches, and then when I ended up at the LCMS one, the difference in the sermons and the difference in, why am I really here, the LCMS actually preached about sin. A lot of these other non-denominational churches, they don't really discuss that much. And I think as human beings, we have a deep need, had a deep need of trying to figure out what's actually going on here. What do I actually need? And I think ultimately, I was looking for how do I make sure that I have this salvation. And starting out and new in the faith, I mean, it was just to me, it was really, for lack of a better term, I mean, eye-opening. It was just a whole different ballgame for me. So I think that's what draws me so much to the Missouri Synod and is because, you guys, you stick to what the Word actually says, and that makes things a lot less confusing for a person that's just trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, John, that oftentimes what God provides for us is not what we think we want, but what God knows we truly need. And when a church doesn't talk about sin, but instead talks about affirmation and so on, if a person knows that they are trapped in sin and despairing, what they don't need is saying, "Oh, you're really okay." No, my conscience tells me without any doubt that I am not.
Not okay.
Yeah, and sometimes what you need to hear is, you're right. You're not okay. You are a lost and an unworthy sinner. But guess what? Despite that, God has still shown his love for you in sending Jesus Christ. And it's countercultural. This is not what you'd expect to, pack in a crowd, which is not what the church is about anyway, but it's an example, exactly as you point out, of God giving us not what we think we want, but what God knows truly that we need. And that's a very good observation on your part. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day, the both of you.
And happy Father's weekend Day, to you,
John.
Too.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, John. To tie in, I've got two stories that tie into it, what John was talking about. I don't know which to go to first. I'm just going to grab the closest one to me. Again, from the Christian Post, where the reporting is far better than the Huffington Post. All right. But this all ties these things together that we're talking about. Rihanna, Rihanna?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The pop singer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I guess, interesting incident with Chris Brown, her former.
Yeah, with the gash on his chin and the fight there, the barroom brawl or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Rihanna shares Joyce Meyer's teaching with fans, calls Christian speaker awesome.
Radical, cool.
Wow, far out, man. Here's where we go. This is some of the things that she enjoys about Joyce Meyer's tweets like this. She follows her on Twitter. If Satan can defeat you in your thoughts, then he can defeat you anywhere else as well.
Well, I don't know about you, but Satan defeats me in my thoughts all the time.
I'm more concerned about who defeated Satan personally, but that's
exactly, which leads to that I cannot do it. I can't live a victorious life. What I think John also could have alluded to in his time in other various non-denominational churches is that when sin is mentioned, it's probably from the standpoint of you can conquer it, you can overcome it, you can go beyond, and you can live the triumphant life. Bull. I've been trying this for a long time, and I have not conquered sin. Satan constantly conquers even my mind, so he's certainly conquering many, many other things as well. And Jesus points out that's truly sin. He says, he who looks at a woman and lusts after has already committed adultery with her in his heart. That mental sin is also sin, and we do not conquer that, contrary to Joyce Myers and whatever else. Yeah. But that means that we need the one, as you point out, who has conquered Satan, because Satan conquers us. Isn't it good to know that our Savior has conquered him who is so powerful over us?
To John's point, and also to what you're saying now, you know the sad thing, Pastor? There are far more people that follow Rihanna and Joyce Meyer than will ever show up in your church on a Sunday.
Yeah, thanks for rubbing that in. I appreciate
that. Well, I'm
not
rubbing it in. What I'm saying is, this is what John's distinction is about, and this is why KFUO plays such an important role, because where else do you talk about things and then get the balance, the Lutheran perspective on the true theology that should be brought to these topics?
You know, I'm reminded of Jesus and the exchange with Peter in John chapter 6. Jesus has just taught about the Lord's Supper. I am the bread of life. Eat my flesh, drink my blood. This is real food, real drink given for the life of the world. And it said that from this time on, many of the crowds did not follow Jesus anymore.
Yeah.
And Jesus turned to the disciples and recognized that, you know, this is a hard teaching and how could people go along with this? And Jesus turns to the disciples and said, what about you? Are you going to leave too? Are you going to abandon me also? Is this teaching too much for you? And Peter, in a great confession, says, Lord, where would we go?
To whom shall we go?
You have the words of eternal life.
Brilliant.
They're not easy words, but they are the only words that we need. They're not designed to pack in an audience. They're not designed to, you know, build a raving listenership or something like that. The words of Jesus are for one purpose alone, to draw us to him in a saving relationship of love, recognizing his sacrifice. That is what Jesus' words are for.
Yeah. You know, Harold called in the other day, and he was referring to this thing he called loony, croony, howl at the moony kind of stuff that you find in the modern church today. Again, much prefer to listen to a sermon from Kirk Clayton rather than to listen to something like this. God works according to the law of gradual growth. So don't be discouraged if your progress seems slow. And then, just to sort of ice that cake, the devil wants to steal your joy because he knows that your joy is your strength. That is why sometimes we need each other.
You know, gradual growth, there is no steady gradual growth in the Christian faith. It's more like mountains and valleys of a very small incremental nature all over the place. And the Christian faith oftentimes feel like you take one step forward and two steps back. Luther, in fact, points this out in, I believe it's his large catechism, where he points out that for Christians, an increasing problem as you grow in faith is despair. Because you recognize, as you grow more in faith, all of the ways that you are failing to work up and live up to God's ways. And so a Christian oftentimes throws up their hands and says, I'm not getting anywhere if I'm getting worse, and give up in despair. Where instead we need to look to Jesus and recognize that he conquers our despair too. And there's nothing that he has not already provided for us.
Just to finish out our last minute here on Ask the Pastor for this Friday, a little something fun to send you into your weekend.
Oh, yes, please.
Just the way people think about things. Christian Scientists are all in a kerfuffle because their membership is shrinking.
Kerfuffle, that's nice.
Yeah, and that's Uwe Simonetto.
It must not be that their membership is shrinking. It just appears that their membership is shrinking. Yeah.
Christian Scientists...
There is nothing that's real. It's just all illusion. Yeah.
It says, who refer to God as Father, Mother, believe that humans are incapable of sin, sickness, and death. Okay, did you get that? They believe that incapable of sin, sickness, and death. And here's the closing line to the story. They're dying out because they're dying off. Perhaps there is a problem with your theology, my friends, you should examine closely.
Just here real quick, a great phrase about Christian Science is a Christian Scientist once had an injury, and she said, I have to admit, the illusion of pain was quite as discomforting as I thought the actual pain would have been.
Folks, you got to think about these things, and you need excellent teachers to help you get through them. Pastor Kirk Clayton, one of the best. We appreciate you coming in. I hope you had fun today.
Happy Friday, or shall we say joyful Friday.
Joyful Friday, and happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
I think
you
we can say happy Father's Day.
Yes,
we'll slide
and you
by
too.
On that one.
Blessed Father's Day to you.
And with your spirit as well. This is it for this week, guys. It's been delightful. It's been fun. We'll get together and do it again Monday with more of Exodus, more of Ask the Pastor. Have a great weekend. Have a great, great Father's Day. Remember that long-suffering father of yours. And especially, you know, don't ask him what he wants to do. Do something for him. Service. That's the point of the church. We'll be back on Monday. We'll miss you till then. Bye-bye.
Listen Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.